It's now my pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, Dermot from San Diego, although I have a sneaky suspicion you're actually from somewhere else. Come on up, buddy. Let's do this. Absolutely.
Hi, Dermot Alcoholic. Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Sean, for asking me to speak here tonight. And congratulations to Jordan, Jean, and Nick. And welcome, Joseph, Frank, Marina, is it? And, Minerva. Meany. And Dylan from Texas. Like Dylan, I'm from Texas as well. I don't know, how did you know I wasn't from here? It's like, I'm a rare species around here. I'm actually a legal immigrant. That was a low blow, right? I filled out the paperwork. I didn't know there was an express tunnel all the way in here, but I'm from Ireland. I grew up in Enniscorthy in County Wexford in Ireland. It's a small town, about 19,000 people, you know, like any kind of a small town, and everybody knows your name, everybody knows your parents, everybody knows what they do, and anytime you do anything, your parents find out about it before you get home. So one of those places, but a really nice place to grow up. You know, it was a safe place. We were in the Republic of Ireland, so we didn't have any of the troubles that you might have seen on the news. That was in Northern Ireland. So we kind of lived in an idyllic country place. But I had my first drink. I didn't realize this until I went to Betty Ford in 2017. I'm 5 years, 1 month and 26 days sober today. I've made the qualification by a month and 26 days. So thanks, John. It kept me sober for the last few weeks, knowing that I had to speak here. But I actually drank in, I'm CIA as well, so Catholic Irish Alcoholic. And when we're 6th grade, you make your confirmation, it's called. It's in the Catholic religion. For any of you that are Catholics, you'd know about it. You basically confirm the vows that your parents made when you were baptized, even though we had no choice, we had to do it anyway. or we would have got a few smacks on the back of the head. But we also had to make a pledge the day we made our confirmation to the Bishop of Ferns to say that we wouldn't drink until we were 18. So my friends and I, we didn't like the Bishop of Ferns. So we drank the day we made the pledge. And nobody noticed. Like, we were able, with the way my family was, my parents liked to drink as well, and they liked to party, and so did their friends. And, like, we would take drink from them and they'd never notice. And we never saw anything wrong with it. You know, as far as I was concerned, that's what the men did, right? Part of growing up was drinking. And the most important thing was not to get sick, you know, not to be able to hold your drink. That was probably the most important thing. And, you know, as long as you didn't get in any serious trouble, there was absolutely nothing wrong with it. And we drank probably most times we got the chance. Whenever our parents were drinking, we knew we could drink. I didn't actually get caught drinking until I was maybe 15 or so. But what happened to me around that time, I'd say I wasn't a bad kid, but I was always in little bits of trouble. So I was always like just an annoyance to the teachers. I was immature. You know, I had a lot of energy. You know, they used to call you a feckin' Egypt back then. I think they call it ADHD or something now here in California. They have a few acronyms for it. But it was basically just, you know, I didn't see anything wrong with it. I loved where I was. But my parents thought it'd be better if I went to this very strict boarding school for boys in the middle of Ireland that was run by these Cistercian monks. And it wasn't a nice place. I didn't like it. Didn't want to go there. But they thought it'd be good for me because my dad had gone to a similar place. And there was a lot of violence there. And it really kind of separated me from my family, I would say. you know, there was one night where somebody tried some funny business with me when I was asleep, but thankfully I had the smarts to avoid it. And I was actually glad that happened, because they said, now they'll have to take me out of here. And they didn't. So I got very angry with them, and it kind of separated me, I would say, from my family. My sisters were younger, so I never really had a relationship with them at the time. And what would happen then is I became, like, in that school, I came in late when I was 14. So I was a bit of an outsider in that place. You know, I was from a different part of the country, and I liked different things and different sports, so I was an outsider. But now when I went back to my hometown with the old friends I used to have, I was always also an outsider. So I kind of felt like I had that imposter syndrome. And obviously then how I treated that was with alcohol. So when we would only get out of that school every Christmas, summer and Easter. It was like 6 days a week. You had to like study every night. Then when I'd get out, I'd just drink like crazy, basically, any chance I got. So I kind of felt like, even back then, you know, I'd always drink whatever was available, drink as much as I could get my hands on, and drink to black out, basically. Again, never saw anything wrong with it. First time I had a problem with it, really, was when I was 17. I was in a coma for a couple of days. My dad was like, "What were you drinking?" When they called the doctor, who was also an alcoholic, by the way, he told my dad at one stage, "Don't drink whiskey anymore. Brown spirits are bad for you. Stick to the white spirits." So then my dad was drinking vodka for a lot of years, thinking that it was okay because it's white spirits. So he rang that doctor, who said, "Pour water in his ear, and if his ear doesn't flinch, he's KO'd or something." And then so the doctor said, "I'll come and see him in the morning." Anyway, the doctor never came. And he said, "Don't bring him to the hospital because they'll probably pump him out." But I woke up from that. And then my dad, all they said to me was, "What were you drinking?" I said, "It was Southern Comfort." I said, "Southern Comfort." And he said, "Just don't drink whiskey again. Wait until you're older to drink whiskey. Stick to the beer." So I did. I took his advice and I did that. But that summer, I went to Greece for 4 months. I actually worked in Greece for 4 months. And I would say that is when we drank alcoholically every night for those 4 months. I would get 4,000 drachmas a day working in a hotel, and I had it all planned out. I could buy one large bottle of Retsina and two large beers and a can of Fanta lemon. And you needed a can of Fanta lemon to pour into the Retsina, because it was basically urine with alcohol in it, and the Fanta lemon would make it drinkable. That was what we did every single night, until that wasn't enough. And then I met this other Irish guy who was on the run from Ireland. And we realised when we blacked out drinking that the Greeks would steal our shoes and steal whatever money we had left. So we started doing that before the Greeks got to them. And that allowed us to drink more. And my plan was to stay there, actually, but... What happened was everyone left in September and there was no more tourists. So I went back home to Ireland and went to college there. I remember at that time my parents been angry with me because I didn't really contact them when I was in Greece. And then college was a great time. I went to college in Ireland in 1992. And the 90s in Ireland were the best time ever. You know, it was 1990 was the first time we qualified for the World Cup in soccer. It was the first economic boom in Ireland, and there was a lot of just optimism about the future. We were part of Europe. The peace process in Northern Ireland was starting to be drafted, and like, it was just a great time. And also what happened around that time was the rave scene came, and ecstasy and LSD, and it was awesome, because we would take ecstasy and we wouldn't drink. At that time they said, you can't drink when you take ecstasy because you'll overheat and you'll die, and they had a lot of stuff in the media about it. And even where they had the raves, there was no alcohol served. Even the cops loved it, because I remember we talked to a cop one night and they pointed out all these like dangerous criminals and ex-IRA men and stuff in the raves, who were basically would give the cops a lot of grief when they drank. But when they were on ecstasy, they were like, tops were off, hugging everybody, telling everybody how much they loved them. And it was just, honestly, a peaceful time. And, you know, I would get anxious coming up in ecstasy. So I would, like, only take one or two. I never, like, took drugs alcoholically. So it was a good time. We just everyone in Ireland just thought, you know, this is it. Like, we've arrived, like Bill says in the book, right? And I would say then after that, I got my first job, and I didn't. That was that settlement period. I didn't like. I built up a lot of resentments against them because after 3 months in the job, I hadn't been promoted. I still wasn't a CEO. I was like, these guys don't know what they're doing. But I also met my wife, Kira, at that time. We'll celebrate 19 years of marriage this September. Yeah, and when I met Kira, that was love at first sight. And it was great. And we also had a great time. We traveled around a lot. We went to Australia shortly after we met. We just had a great time, a lot of parties and a lot of traveling, but not really any major issues, right? I know Kira will tell me there was a few warning signs, like when they put me to sleep in rubbish bags and stuff like that, so they could still go out for the rest of the night. And you know, sometimes just black out a lot, right? Just drink to oblivion. But you know, we were young and we thought, you know, that's what all our friends were doing as well, right? But there was one night I went out for a Christmas party and I jumped into the River Liffey in Dublin in the middle of December, which was flowing really hard. It was very cold at the time. And I remember when I hit the water, I just kind of came to. And I knew I needed to swim that way to get over to the ladder that was in that direction. And when I got to the ladder, I was exhausted from the swim. And somebody pulled me out. I can't even remember what they looked like. And I woke up in the ambulance with a foil blanket wrapped around me. And I went the next morning in the hospital. The doctor came to see me and said, you know, there's a strong smell of drink off you. Do you think you have a problem with alcohol? And that's kind of, to be honest, it just frightened the life out of me when she said that. Because it was never a question I had asked myself. And they said, can we call your parents? I said, absolutely not. So they called Kira, who'd been going out with me for 3 months at the time. So there you go. We're still together today. So that was a good sign. But we had a great time in Australia, I would say. And then we came back to Ireland to kind of get serious and settle down. And we started working. And we worked really hard. And for me, I think, you know, fear was something that drove me. I was very ambitious because I was scared. You know, I still felt like that imposter back in Ireland in my hometown. And I think both of us were very driven, actually. But around 2003, and we were like, we worked hard and we partied hard. But never saw any issues with how the alcohol consumption was going. But in around 2003, Kira's best friend, Irene, we lost her to suicide. And she was married to a friend of mine. And our hometown was very unforgiving about that. It was very cruel, you know, in what they said about her. And we just didn't get any support. So we got out of Dodge. And my sister was in Taiwan at the time. And she said, you can come over to Taiwan and get an apartment there. And she had a spare room in her apartment. So that's what we did to kind of get out of Ireland and get some headspace. And again, we had a great time traveling around. We definitely partied a lot there as well, even though there's not a big drink culture there. There's not many bars. You know, we hung out with all the other foreigners there, and we had a great time. And I met an Irish guy there in 2003, and we set up a business together. And we returned back from Taiwan to Ireland in 2004. Kind of when things calmed down, and we started to run that business, and he stayed in Taiwan, and We still have that business going today that I'll probably tell you more about later. But when we got back, we built a house in Ireland. We got married and we had our first son in 2007. Rian, he's 17 today. And then we had our second, Killian, in 2010. And, you know, I think that was around the time where I needed to become a responsible husband and father. But, you know, I wasn't able to stop drinking. It wasn't as easy to turn it off as I thought, you know. Like, in fairness, I had seen some guys do, right? When you get married, you settle down, you kind of cop onto yourself and take your foot off the gas. But with the business, I was traveling a lot as well, and I in my head, I had it that it's my job to drink and bring clients out to drink. You know, there's a guy in our home, my home group's Mount Soledad Men's. A few of them are here tonight. Thanks, guys, for your support. And there's a guy in that meeting called American League John that you probably all know. And he's so I kind of compare it to him, the guy that has to bring the client out for drinks. I was very good at that. It's funny, I was always able to find the customers that like to drink as well. I don't know how that works. But in places like, you know, South Africa and England and places like that, I would have the best customers that always love to drink. And I told myself it was a good business strategy. That's how I justified it. And then in 2011, we came over here to set up the US side of that business. And there was there was four of us at that stage. We the plan was to just come here for 6 to 12 months, set up the office, and then go back to Ireland. But you know, for me anyway, the business went well here. And I think around that time when we came over, we were having some challenges with our own families, both of us, both Ciara and I. And it was, you know, we were a little bit isolated over here. And in 2012, we lost a baby girl called Alana, was her name, at 22 weeks. And it was, you know, it was a very traumatic experience for us. I remember we were given a little body, and we had to bring it for cremation in Imperial Beach area. So it was very industrial, and I had no tools to deal with that myself. I had no tools or knew how to support Ciara. And so I kind of put my foot on the gas again and resorted to my solution, which was drink. I remember that day I bought our other two kids to the Miramar Air Show, so that Ciara could rest, and drank all day at the air show. I remember the 17-year-old was four at the time. He took a drink out of my Coke bottle and spat it out in front of a line of people. And the jig was up. Well, but I didn't care. I kept going. But when I came home, Ciara was obviously very worried about where it was gone, and driving the kids around in the car. And my solution that time was to go to AA. So I went to three AA meetings in 2012, and I could not relate to anything that was said. It was like I heard people calling it before, like it was listening to Charlie Brown listening to his teacher. Just wah. All I heard was God, and I told myself this is an American program for religious people. It was some sort of a cult or something like that. Or when the basket was being handed around, I thought maybe it was a Ponzi scheme or something. But at the third meeting, the secretary that I met was also having doubts about his alcoholism. So he said I needed to decide whether I was an alcohol abuser or an alcoholic. And I agreed with him that I was just an alcohol abuser. I went home to tell Ciara the good news. You know, on it went from there. But I would say from that moment was when my drinking was not fun anymore. It became, I isolated. I, you know, hid my drinking. I would wake up in the morning and say, first thing I would kind of have is, you know, what happened at the end of last night? Did I hide all the bottles? You know, Where did I put this? Where did I put that? And then I'd say, right, I'm not drinking today. I'm definitely not drinking today. At some stage, I would maybe try and do some exercise, like some sort of a run or go to the gym or something like that. And then after that, I would get anxiety and feel all anxious, and then I'd need a drink to calm it down. After a while, it kind of got so bad with the anxiety and panic attacks, I would need a drink just to drive. So I had myself convinced that it was safer to drink before I drove on the freeway, because if I was on the freeway, I would have a panic attack, and I felt that was too dangerous. So that was the kind of the thinking that I had. I was drinking in work as well. It's funny, we went to a new office in 2015, and I had a bar set up in the office, and there was drink left over from the opening party, and the drink levels were going down on the bottles in the bar. And the VP of the office asked me, like, "Some one of the guys is drinking this stuff." I said, "I don't know who it could be." So she said, "We're going to lock it up in the room." There was this room beside my office that had a code on it. And funnily enough, there was only two or three of us that knew the code. The drink levels kept going down even after they locked it up. But I still, it's an amends I actually have to make to that guy now, because I did let somebody else take the blame for that, now that I think about it. I know. But, you know, that's kind of the way it was. It was just, for me, I remember going to the doctor, and because I had a panic attack on the plane, and I didn't know what was wrong with me. I thought I was having a heart attack. And I was like, "Oh, I'm hitting 40, I'm getting old, I'm losing my marbles. I don't know what's wrong with me." So I went to the doctor. He said, "I think you have asthma again." I had asthma when I was a kid, and "I think you have asthma again. I'm going to send you to the allergist or whatever. And here's some Xanax for your panic attack next time you're on a plane." But, you know, and that was, and I did go to the doctor, and it was asthma I had again. But, you know, there was still no warning about the panic attacks. So for me, the solution to the panic attack was whiskey. So anytime anxiety hit me, there was a solution. It was whiskey. And I was kind of glad that I had that solution. And at this stage, you know, I kind of accepted I had a drink problem, but I didn't know what to do about it. You know, growing up, my heroes were alcoholics. You know, my biggest hero was Diego Maradona. And he was, because he was an alcoholic and a coke addict, and he hung out with nightclubs in Napoli with the mafia, and he was the best soccer player in the world. And to me, that was the pinnacle, you know. And I would watch MTV and see everyone in America is having fun at pool parties, you know, smoking weed and drinking Colt 45, and, you know, that's, everyone's having this fun, right? So I kind of always, you know, I thought alcohol was this great thing. Do you know what I mean? That's what successful people do. That's what people that are happy do. That's what you do when you celebrate. So, you know, it was the last thing I ever wanted to blame for my problem. And my problem at that time was all in here. And we had, unfortunately, we lost two more babies in that time. And around 2016, Kira asked me, would I go and see a doctor to help her? And I said, of course I would, because obviously she needed help at the time. And the doctor was a marriage counsellor. And the first thing he said to me was, "Do you think your drinking has anything to do with your relationship issues?" And my answer was maybe. But in my head, I was looking at him going, "You're old, you're from California, and you're a doctor. What would you know about drinking? And I don't have any relationship issues." But what happened with him was he said, "Right, your drink is a problem. Any more than two drinks and you're intoxicated." That's what he said, which goes to show you what he knew, right? I was like, that's not even an appetizer. You know, it's two drinks. So he said, try two drinks. I said, "Well, can we make it four? Because at least I'm getting a buzz at four, too. I'm not, like, even registering." And he said, "Okay, four drinks. Try four drinks." We got into the car. I said to Kira, "That's really eight for me, because I'm Irish. I've been drinking all my life." And she agreed to that. And then I said, that's 16 because I'll be able to double up and I'll be able to drink in between. And what happened was trying to manage that to be like between 8 and 16 drinks was actually a complete nightmare. You know, there's a part in the book, page 328. And I heard a guy say this at a meeting and I thought he was like some sort of a messiah. But it's actually here in the book. She finally realized that when she enjoyed her drinking, she couldn't control it. And when she controlled it, she couldn't enjoy it. And that's what happened to me at that time. I was like, this is an absolute nightmare. So I went back to him and I gave in and I said, that's it. I can't do it. I need to give it up. I can't moderate my drinking. It's impossible and it's driving me crazy. And it was, again, just making it. That it was the obsession. All I was thinking about was drinking, how to manage it, how to only have the 8 to 16 and how I was going to hide it. It was like driving me crazy. And so I gave up and then tried to give it up myself. And then I realized, you know, maybe I do have something like that ADHD or something, because my mind, once I gave it up, this just went like a Ferrari. It was just going all the time. I didn't know what was wrong with it. It was just like on the outside, everything was okay. But up here, this was going crazy because I had no solution anymore. I didn't have the whiskey to calm it down. When I had anxiety, I had no solution. When I had fear, I had no solution. And then around, that was April 2017. And then in August, I said, I need to have one drink just to stop the noise. And 4 months later, I ended up in Betty Ford. So it was the proof that, you know, you don't just have one drink. I have gone for one drink thousands of times, and I never had one drink. And Betty Ford was it reminded me of boarding school. It was like, what the hell is this? I do not want to be here. I have nothing in common with anybody here. You know, some of these guys are on Oxy and stuff. You know, I just have a drink problem. But it was good for education. You know, when we landed there first, the Serenity Prayer was on the outside. I remember reading it going like, I think that's some sort of Native American prayer or something like that. I was like, what's serenity is something that when you smoke weed, you get serenity and when you meditate. But on the way in, the doctor that spoke to me, he said, like, he saw that I had asthma. And he said, you know, asthma is a disease with no cure. But it's a disease that you can manage. You have an inhaler that you take every day, and you stay away from smoke and irritants, and you can manage asthma where you can exercise again and you can live your life. He said alcoholism is the same. It's a disease with no cure, but there's a way to manage it so that it doesn't affect your life. And that was a great thing he said to me. He did kind of leave a door open in that he said, but it's hard for you because of your culture and your family and stuff like that. And I was like, yeah, you're right. You know, I had a lot of blame in Betty Ford. I was blaming, you know, that culture maybe and that and the alcohol and my parents a lot in Betty Ford. And but I learned a lot about the allergy. OK, I learned that we have an allergy, that when we take that first drink, we crave a second one, and when we take the second one, we have an even stronger craving for the third one. And I didn't know that. I didn't know about the obsession of the mind. I didn't know that when we're not drinking, that's what all we think about. And I could definitely relate to that, because for those previous years, that's what I was thinking about all the time. What I was going to drink, how much I was going to drink, where I was going to get it, you know, what I was going to drink. It was just nonstop. And it took me a couple of years to lose that obsession. And the other thing I learned there was we can break the cycle. You know, that this, a lot of the time, this comes from our environment. It's handed down from the families, the behavior to the kids. And we had three kids at the time, and I thought that was a great opportunity for me to break the cycle and give, you know, not, you know, have my kids to grow up in the same way I grew up with alcohol. So it was great for education. Also meditation. I never meditated before. It was kind of like that, you know, prayer. I thought that was for hippies. I thought it was like, you know, something you did when you were on a lot of drugs. But we did, they did our first guided meditations. The first one they did was, they bought us to find the inner child. It was like a 35-minute meditation. And like, it really, I was amazed by it. It really got me into a deep meditative state. And I found the inner child, who was this lonely child just before I went to that school, that was 14 years of age, that was alone and that was scared. And that was remarkable for me, that the child was alone and the child was scared. And, you know, the thing that that great marriage counsellor told me that pissed me off as well at the time was that you have the emotional maturity of an 11-year-old, because that's when you started drinking. And, like, I remember even, like, because I was seeing him on my own for a while afterwards, and a couple of years later I said, like, so what level am I at now, like 30, 35? He said, high school. I was like, what? I wasn't happy, but I did steps 1, 2, and 3 in Betty Ford, and then the guy told me, when you get out of Betty Ford, go to Mount Soledad Men's, because it's close to where you live, get a sponsor and do the fourth step. And I didn't like that either, because I was like doing all the homework perfectly in Betty Ford, and I wanted to keep going. But coincidentally, I had a friend that was a couple of years sober at the time, and who had also been in Betty Ford, and he bought me to Mount Soledad Men's. It was the, I got out of Betty Ford on a Thursday and went to Living Free on the Friday. Tom Carey was there with Davis on my first meeting. They were laughing and joking at 7 o'clock in the morning. I was like, what? I need to figure out what drugs these guys are taking, because they've given up drink, but they're really happy. It doesn't make any sense. And my second meeting was Mount Soledad Men's. And, you know, that meeting's been great for me. I became a member of that group. You know, I've four sponsors. I'm on my fourth sponsor from there. I'm kind of looking for one at the moment. And I tell you, Frederick, you won't be on the list anyway, that's for sure. I'm striking you off the potentials. You know, I also joined the Surf Rats, Mount Soledad Men's Surf Rats, a group of us that go surfing before the meeting every Saturday. And that's where I met John. And, you know, it's really changed my life, to be honest with you. And that wasn't enough for me, too. I did, like, after a year or two, I was still, you know, not back to myself, as Kira would say. And I did therapy for myself, that with someone that specializes in therapy for alcoholism. And that, you know, really got me back to my childhood and unearthed the fact that I was upset with my parents and my family and that whole school situation. And you know, even though it wasn't that much of a problem, it still affected me. And it was, you know, one of the causes of why I didn't realize I had low self-esteem and that I was beating myself up all the time. I didn't know that. And I've come to find out it's a common trait in AA. And the therapy was great for that. You know, therapy made me sick for the first few times I did it. I felt physically sick after it, and I actually wanted to drink after it, even though I'd lost the obsession that time. But I would recommend it to any. It worked for me doing that in parallel. But, you know, it's, and ever since that, it's like, it's just been wins and wins and wins for me. Like, I love winning. I hate losing. I'm very competitive. You know, as I said earlier, fear is one of the things that drives me, and I have a fear of losing. But like, when I came into AA, I thought this was a room of losers, and I don't think like that anymore. I think this is a room of winners. Everyone in here is not drinking today. Not only do we like help ourselves, we like whatever the opposite of collateral damage is, right? Collateral construction or whatever. Everyone that lives in our lives benefits from us being sober today. You know, imagine what it would be like in San Diego area alone if all of us were drinking today, and how many people it would affect, right? And, you know, it's one of the reasons I love living here now is I heard in a meeting one day, this was the Riviera of recovery, and it's, I love it because recovery is embraced in the community here. And, you know, you guys know, anywhere you look, there's thousands of meetings on in Southern California every day. And it's I love the camaraderie that's here, you know, the fellowship. You know, it's in the book here. where it talks about it. It says, there exists among us a fellowship, a friendliness, and an understanding which is indescribably wonderful. And I find that to be true. Without the fellowship, you know, we can't do this alone. So for those newcomers, you know, find your fellowship, find the meetings that you like and the groups that you like, and hang on tight to that. But like for me, everything else has been a win. Like my relationship with Kira has dramatically improved. I've become a father that's present. I didn't think being a father was hard when I was drinking. I thought it was easy. Now that I'm 5 years sober, I'm going, geez, this is tough. You know, but like, I'm a good enough dad today. You know, for me, I was always beating myself up because I wasn't this like fairy tale dad, right? But now I'm happy with the dad that I am today. You know, I think I'm good enough, and we make mistakes, but you know, we face into them. The workplace, that Irish guy you met in Taiwan, you know, me and him both had a midlife crisis at the same time, about 2012, and we had a very toxic relationship. And I was going to leave in 2017, but you know, because I got sober and applied the steps to my work life in terms of how much resentments were eating me up. Resentments is the number one offender, it says in the book. That's true for me. You know, and in the workplace, I had still a lot of resentments. I still had a lot of stuff that I needed to resolve. You know, I was in a lot of trouble in the workplace, not because I had done anything wrong, but how I handled things, because I was drinking half the time. So I had to fix all that and then turn the toxic relationship around, where I was going to leave into, actually, he's gone. And now I'm the CEO of the company, and, you know, the company has done really, really well since I've gotten rid of him and gotten sober, to be honest. I couldn't do that without my program and without my higher power. The main objective of this book is to find a higher power. We were all religious growing up, in terms of it was more of a forced religion. And like that drink I had the first day of my confirmation, I just kind of turned against it. You know, I didn't want to know. I saw a lot of hypocrisy in it, and I got the spirituality and the religion mixed up, you know. But I realized this is, you know, someone told me early on in AA, it's a spiritual program, it's not a religious program. And what I love about it is, for me, it's more like, you know, in appendix two, I didn't have the white flash or the burning bush moment. It's been a gradual ongoing strengthening of the relationship with my higher power, you know, defining that. At the start, it was just the meetings themselves. I could feel a power from the meetings. I felt better after the meetings. I didn't like a lot of the meetings. I always liked Mount Soledad Men's, but I always felt better after meetings. And that was the first kind of power I felt from it. And then it became nature, and now it's like the spirit of the universe, and I'm constantly working on improving my relationship with my higher power. And what I also realize, it's a practice, right? Meditation and prayer, it's a practice. You have to do it. And you even at the start, when it didn't make any sense, just starting the habit of doing it every day really, really helps. And then just like, you know, superficial stuff like financial freedom. My finances have turned around. I've learned how to surf in my 40s. I've learned how to ski in my 40s. I just started jiu-jitsu a couple of weeks ago, did it with my two kids as well. And, you know, everything has just gotten better. And all that stuff is a result because of what happened, because of, you know, me realizing I was an alcoholic and handing it over. You know, I really battled with it at the start. You know, I tried to find ways around it. I had a couple of relapses the first couple of years. But I kept coming back. You know, I kept coming back. And the last time, I just completely surrendered. Because someone told me once, if you've done a fourth step, you'll never drink with peace again. And I found that to be true. You know, if you've done some steps and then you go drinking, it brings you to a very, very dark place. And I, you know, but I don't even, I would never want to go there again anyway, because the life I have today as a result of this is just too good. You know, I now feel like a winner. You know, I didn't realize since that 11 years of age, I was beating myself up, telling myself I wasn't good enough. When I came in, I was the egomaniac with the inferiority complex. you know, I needed some tough love from guys in Mount Soledad Men's that told me I was full of it and I needed to get a sponsor and I needed to do the steps. And eventually I got that. And then once I surrendered and said, OK, I'll do the meetings, I'll do the steps, I'll do the 90 and 90 this time. I said I did it the times before, but I didn't. But this time I actually did the 90 and 90. And now, you know, I try and do something every day. You know, I wake up to one of the guys, old-timers in Mount Soledad Men, sends me the prayer, meditation and thought for the day, and I send it on to some of the other guys. And, you know, we have a surf chat group that's not exactly a spiritual surf chat, but it still keeps you connected. You know, like, I feel it still every day connects me to the guys. And that's what's really important. So, you know, if you're new, just, you know, try not to beat yourself up. Realize that this is a room of winners. It's really hard to do this. You know, I was expecting, you know, after the first time I got 90 days, I was disgusted because all I got was that San Diego chip. And it was the same when I started therapy. I thought she was going to tell me how wonderful I am. But there was one word that both those therapists gave me that they told me I was resilient. And I was resilient when I was drinking as well. You know, when I was young, I was able to drink a lot without getting sick, like the rule said. And I never kind of gave up on the booze. You know, it was like, we keep going till the end. We'll always find more. And I needed that resilience in AA as well, because there's a lot of temptations. You know, it's literally everywhere. And it was really hard the first couple of years. And it's really hard to watch people you love, like my parents, not be able to get it too, you know. And my dad had a heart attack in COVID and he had seizures last year from when he gave up the booze. And it's hard to see it when you know, like, what's on this side of it, what's this side is available to you. So, you know, one thing we can always say is we have that resilience, because for you to come through the years of drinking and drugging, for, I know, a lot of people as well, it takes a lot of resilience. And we're lucky to be here. And we're even luckier that we have this opportunity through the steps to find peace of mind. I thought that, again, was just some BS that people did when they were high. But I've actually had peace of mind in the last year. And it's amazing. I didn't realise I never had it because I never had it. Now I have it. I went, oh, my God, this is amazing. And there was some, you know, even last year, there was like ups and downs of peace of mind. But what I did at the start of this year was I heard people in meetings say, I'll do steps every month. So January, I did step one. February, I did step two, etc. And then when I got to step four again, every time I've done step four, I've had a spiritual experience. And this time I had 35 resentments. That was even more than the first time. And they weren't as extreme, but they're still resentments. And they were still making me uncomfortable. And they were preventing me from being in a state of peace of mind. So I've realized now, you know, when I don't do AA, I'm about 10 to 14 days away from feeling really restless, irritable and discontent. So I make sure I don't go there. And I keep doing it. And that's why I said yes to John when he asked. And he's also smart because he asks you a good time in advance. So it's like, oh, yeah, that's ages away. But I'm really appreciate you guys asking me to speak here tonight. And for the newcomers, just remember you're a champion. You should be proud of the journey that we've taken. And this is the best opportunity you'll ever have. So grab it with both hands. Thanks for letting me share.
Dermot, that was great. Thank you very much for sharing. Please come back and share again with us. One more time for Dermot. I told Dermot a good speaker ends on time, a great speaker ends early. So one more time for Dermot, the greatest speaker ever. Hey, just want to say congratulations to Jordan, Gene, and Nick. Thank you to the Women's Auxiliary and the Men of the House for a great dinner tonight. Let's circle up.